Group meeting, Friday, 11th March, 1983. I think you have heard me, and you have probably read this also, that in order to realize the fruits of the religious life in the real sense, start from the other shore. In other words, if we are concerned with transcendence in its reality, then we start from the other shore, which is here and now. And in any case, there is no option to that. Because the starting point necessarily has to be ourselves as we are at present. One can't get away from that. We can't sort of suddenly wish or aspire to realizing the purpose of our existence or whatever we like to call it, and start so many stages ahead. Growth takes place step by step. Sometimes the steps can be so quick that it seems as if one has vaulted on to a much higher stage. I rather doubt if that ever actually happens. It seems so. But probably what has actually happened is that there has been a process of development going on without our quite knowing it. And the point is reached where we suddenly become aware of a deeper state altogether. There is a deepening of consciousness, a greater sensitivity to everything. Now, as far as the conscious part of the story is concerned, is it not moving? It is a great help to be aware in some degree or other of the direction in which the movement takes place. To put it in another form, we have to be aware of the purpose of our existence and whither we are going. Otherwise, we just make efforts in the dark without knowing what we are about. And this involves an understanding of the fact that throughout the universe there is this developmental process going on, where we human beings are concerned, what specially is the nature of that development. What is it that develops in the true sense of the word? You have heard me say quite often that the whole of the spiritual life is actually a complete transformation of our mode of awareness of ourselves, of the world in which we live, of our relationship to it, and so on. You see? All right? If this transformation of the mode of consciousness is to take place, we have to have some sense, some idea of what we mean by consciousness. And herein comes a great difficulty. Consciousness, as certainly as I use it, is something which is indefinable. We all know what we mean by being conscious of this or that. Our senses function. Impressions are sent to the brain. And the brain, if one is actually paying attention, enables us to be conscious of the presence of a sight, an object, to be conscious of a sound, of a taste, a touch, and so on. But if we are not paying attention, we may well miss being conscious of the thing. I wonder if any of us have had the experience of being so absorbed with some thought or problem or something whilst we are walking along the pavement that we bump into somebody or a motor car or something standing just by the side there. This sort of thing can happen simply because we are not paying attention, because the impressions from the person who is walking on the pavement towards us, or the impressions from the object which is just there, they are constantly within our line of vision. But although they are within our line of vision, and the purely physical process of light rays entering the eyes and making their impression at the back of the brain goes on, because we are not attending, we don't know that we are going to bump into the person or the object. So we are not conscious of the person or the object. Now, that we can clearly understand what it means to be conscious of this, that, or the other. But what precisely is consciousness? Now, Krishnamurti always says that the content of consciousness is consciousness. Somehow, I can't be quite in sympathy with that outlook. The content, your psychical content, makes up your psyche. That's true. And all your mental processes, your conditioning, your ideas, your beliefs, your conceptions, and so on, whether they are the result of experience or study or whatever they are, they make up the content of your psyche. Psychologically, you will function, therefore, controlled by that conditioning. You see? But consciousness is something over and above. It is not special to you or to me or to anybody. It is universal. But it functions as if it is special through the medium of the psychical functioning. You see? Now, consciousness is that aspect, that universal aspect of the total reality, which enables knowledge to grow within oneself. You come to know this, that, or the other, first in the conditioned way, because the brain is usurping the mind. The brain is the concretest part of mind. Mind, again, is a word which stands for something universal, something total, you see. So to talk of my mind or my consciousness is a mistaken way of talking. What we actually mean when we use those terms is that my psychological processes, my feelings, the thoughts that spring up, the reactions that go out from me, the decisions I make and all that sort of thing, that one can legitimately say is mine, because it is quite different from yours or yours or yours or anybody else's in the world. This is something special to the particular living organism, the person, as we say. But consciousness is universal altogether, and it is that element which ultimately enables the psyche to become pure, purified, the mind, what we call mind, to become enlightened. The brain doesn't get enlightened. The brain is a machine, not to be despised. Far from it. It is absolutely indispensable. We know the results of the brainless so-called thinking and desiring and acting the world over, and all the horrible consequences of it, you see. So the brain is indispensable. This thing has to be the like NASA is for the flights to the moon and so forth, you see. It's a marvelous computer. So marvelous that if you tried to build a computer which would perform all the activities of the brain as such, it would have to be the size of St. Paul's Cathedral, they say. You see, somewhat big. So there we are. The brain of any average person, leave alone a genius or extremely knowledgeable person, the brain of the average person contains so many bits of information. This is how the scientists talk of it, bits of information, that information, if written out quite succinctly, in the English language, would fill just 20 million volumes. So it's an extraordinary fact that this little box, bony box at the top of our bodies, which contains the brain, holds 20 million volume, a 20 million volume library of information as such. All these bits of information are involved in with the carrying on of the whole living process of the body and the psychical processes as such. Now, what the developmental process involves, the purification of the psyche, that is to say, freeing the psyche from the limitations imposed upon it by all the thought patterns, the conceptions, which are mostly misconceptions, until one really begins to know things properly, and so on. That developmental process involves this purification of the psyche, which means it is both a mental and a moral process. It is not purely intellectual, it's not entirely emotional, it's all these things, the whole psychical life of the person as such. And as that psychical life becomes purified, then what we commonly call the intellect as such, now one has begun to transcend intellect as such, in fact, begins to have a true insight into things, into the real nature of things. This insight into the real nature of things is the developmental process of consciousness itself, as it functions through you, the particular individual. One gets free of all the encumbering lumber which fills the whole psyche, you see, and prevents complete insight. I say insight, but that word has to cover the perfection of functioning of our sense of sight, our sense of hearing, of touch, of taste, of all our senses. That is why you'll all remember how many numberless times throughout these years I've said that the senses are the cords of communion with reality, with the truth. They are the cords of communion. Then when you see or hear or touch or taste or whatever it is, you are no longer a separate subject, seeing or hearing, etc., a different object. That divorce between the self and the not-self disappears. Then there is a true consciousness of the unity of the universe, starting with a true consciousness of the unity of your own whole psychophysical organism. Very few of us have a real sense of unity about it. When we do have this sense of unity, and you are truly conscious of it, you are unknowingly conscious of it. That's a curious thing to say. But this, I use this term deliberately because the consciousness is of such a nature that it does not need a thought process, a controlling process, to play any part in being conscious like that. There is complete freedom. This is perhaps the meaning of the Buddha saying, the purpose of the holy life is to realize complete freedom of mind. It is not to that your intellect may be sharpened, that you may be able to achieve this, that or the other, or attain anything and so forth, but to have complete freedom of mind. And here, of course, mind is associated with consciousness as such in its universal sense. You see, this complete freedom comes about. Therefore, it is a freedom such that there is no necessity for making any sort of thought picture of the impressions which you receive through sight or sound or touch or taste, etc. You don't make thought forms, which are always limited structures, and they can be obstructive, very obstructive, because they limit you. And through that limitation, one cannot form whole, perfect relationships with the world around or within one's own self. You know how within one's own self one is constantly at war, in confusion, in misery, in this, that and the other, all the time. It's extremely rare to be in that state where you are perfectly free and perfectly happy. Happy without any sort of disturbance. The ordinary happiness we know of and experience, the happiness which we identify with pleasure, there is always commotion there. There is a turmoil. There isn't that absolute stillness, that steadiness, that sort of rock-like steadiness, which is the peace that passes understanding. But where there is the true happiness, I don't fully understand it myself, but I'm just able to say this, that this is a fact. This freedom, which is utter stillness, this utter peace, but this freedom and utter peace are the real doing by the individual. The individual who has, to use the old phrase, reached the other shore. But you haven't gone anywhere out of yourself. It all happens inside here, inside, within oneself. So now, in this developmental process then, when that sort of state comes into being, it is a state which is nondescript. It can be suggested by certain words, but it cannot be given a description of a nature which is comparable to the analytical description which your keen observer, as we say, the fellow who is sent out to produce a documentary or this, that and the other, and he observes everything that's going on, and our news correspondent in such and such a place. You see, it's not that sort of thing at all. It is perfectly quiet. And in being quiet, there is no limited presentation of objects, separate objects, objective facts as we call them. It isn't that. It is a most extraordinary kind of unknowing knowing. See, this is perhaps something which of the true meaning of the word omniscience. It's an all-knowing without analytically separating out portions of it. Then it is not full knowing. The full knowing is of such a nature as perhaps that statement in the New Testament. Not a sparrow falleth to the ground, but my Father in heaven knoweth it. Notice what Jesus says. He doesn't say, I know it. But we can definitely deduce that this applies to him too, simply because he says categorically, I and my Father are one. He says, I tell you these things because my Father told me. If my father had not told me, I could not tell you these things. Now, what is that father which tells him? Might it not be this consciousness come to full light? It is the completely enlightened state. And it's an extraordinary state. It is a state whose context, you've heard this before too, especially since 1979. It's a state whose context is the infinite, the eternal, the immortal. Now don't, when we say infinite, translate it as not finite. Otherwise, you know, the moment the word infinity is used, what our brains do is this. See, I throw both my hands out. I would have to spread them out to the ends of the universe and more, if that is possible, you see. And that is the kind of impression that the word infinite immediately rouses up in the brain and the psyche. But that is not the extraordinary thing is that the whole of infinity is completely embodied in every finite thing, the smallest possible thing. Was it Blake? What is it? The world in a grain of sand? Use that line. A world in a grain of sand. It is that kind of thing. You see, if you can free the brain, you have to free the brain here from always associating the idea of size and of measurement with the word infinity, then you can somehow begin to get conscious of what infinity actually means. Otherwise, whatever meanings we make of it, we make out of our own imperfect ideas and conceptions and measurements and limitations and so forth. And it isn't true. But in that infinity, supposing you can be conscious that way, it might be quite a useful thing to meditate on. Meditate in the real sense. Don't go writing long essays about infinity. Just try and let the brain be quiet. Let it quieten down. If it doesn't quieten down, don't bother. Go and have a cup of coffee or whatever you want. And when the spirit and the flesh both move, try again. And perhaps you might suddenly get some peculiar enlightenment about it. And then again, this word eternity. You see, you have heard this so often that I need not repeat it. Neither endless time nor timelessness is eternity. Eternity subsumes both of them. Eternity rides on the wings of time. I've said that 1,000 times if I've said it once. Eternity rides on the wings of time. And eternity completely subsumes all experiences of timelessness. But consider, if you like, it may help you. We think in terms of everything beginning, something begins, don't we? A child is born, and the child grows. Or you plant a seed, and a tree comes out of it. And you say, it began with planting that seed. Or you may plan out some course of action for the coming week or something. So you begin and proceed, as we say, you see. So in a sense, there is a beginning. But what sort of a sense is that sense? It is the whole sense of limitation, which is the result of our consciousness being constricted by our being limited to the functioning of our senses and the brain, which is very conditioned all the time. It has to measure, it has to draw boundaries and so forth. You see, all that is there. Now, take the word time, if you like, to start with, which we associate with the idea of beginning, proceeding, ending, don't we? All right. What was there before the beginning? Nothing. Nothing? Or was there something of which we do not know anything? Think of the no beginning state. The no beginning state. From the no beginning state, the only next step is what we commonly call a beginning. But that beginning is something limited then, isn't it? Something particular. Where the no beginning state is concerned, there is peace. But it is the peace of ignorance, because we don't know. You can't be frightened of what you don't know. The dark is not actually frightening. It is because we imagine all sorts of things in relationship to the dark that we get frightened. So, in the same way, in this no beginning state, there is no fear. And there is the peace of ignorance. We don't know what is the no beginning. But if one is quiet, in quiet moments, you will find that a peculiar little vibration of eternity will be present. Eternity cannot begin, can it? By definition, by ordinary definition. Eternity is eternity. But in that ordinary definition, we associate infinite time in the sense of a straight line movement. Endless time, the endless past, going endlessly into the past, going endlessly into the future. But that is purely a verbal definition. That is not something of which we are really conscious. Eternity cannot be unidirectional. If it is unidirectional, then it is something quite limited. Take a line, a straight line. It is from our experience of a straight line that we understand the meaning of unidirectionality, don't we? So that is something limited. But the implication of words like infinity and eternity is complete unlimitedness, totality. But it's a totality which neither negates nor destroys the actuality of the limited and the particular and the finite and so on. You see, one may say that all this sort of philosophizing or this sort of metaphysics, where does it lead one to? Nowhere. But if you can go nowhere, you'll become conscious of the infinite and of eternity. Why? How? Because all the limiting conceptions born of our experience through the senses and the activity of the brain are out now. They are out. They no longer hinder. People meet socially, as they say, and they have drinks and this and that and smoke 50 cigarettes each or whatever it is, what happens to the room? It's absolutely filled with choking smoke, isn't it? Now, the limitations which are produced by the activity of our senses and brain combined, and they are all the impressions which we get through our senses are interpreted in a particular way. We are taught that right from childhood. Recall your childhood and see how parents, friends, that is not so, you mustn't do that, etc., etc., etc. All the musts and the must-nots and so forth. And so the brain is forced to interpret everything in these particular ways and no other. Well, then where is freedom of the mind? If this indispensable computer is going to, we are feeding it, you know, the input is the wrong sort of input. What is the output? Well, look at the world. It's like that. So now, let go. And this is the difficulty. Oh, but you see, I've got this responsibility. I've got to do this, I've got to do the other. Yes, of course, I've got to do this, I've got to do the other. But inside me, myself, psychologically, there are all the limiting factors, the spoiling factors. If those limiting and spoiling factors are out, then I will carry out my responsibilities. I will do this, that and the other. Have dinner at 7 o'clock with John Brown next Wednesday or whatever it is. You see, all that will happen. It will happen naturally, spontaneously and transcendentally. This is the extraordinary thing. Sometimes one does experience the transcendent right here. It may be in reading a book. You suddenly see a new depth, a new meaning, something tremendously profound in a simple sentence of even 5 or 6 words only. Now you see, you read that sentence again and again because you liked the book or the story or whatever it was, you see. You liked it, you read it again, and you just passed over. Your consciousness didn't take it in. When suddenly this consciousness gets this enlightenment, My goodness. Yes, that's it. And lo and behold, the transcendent has taken place in the particular, the limited. Can we find transcendence in muck? But what we call muck is necessary for the fertility of the soil, isn't it? And look what happens in consequence. What beauty, what growth, what harmony emerges out of that fertility of the soil. It is a little bit like that. Don't take these analogies too literally. Now, we might pursue this one for a little while. What does the muck do to the soil? And what does the soil do to the muck? They interact. And there is a transformation process going on chemically all the time. You see? A transformation process, which is a purifying process, a healing process. And all the jolly little worms and microbes and everybody, they have a marvelous time enjoying themselves with this interaction between the earth and the muck on it. Now, perhaps if we, I don't know, it may help us to deal with, to face, and rightly deal, therefore, with all that happens to us. Falling ill, for instance, as I have done recently, is a case of this muck. Too much muck. All right? But the muck interacting with that which it is mucking releases light, understanding, beauty, peace, quietness, and so forth. One doesn't need to go to anybody for it. Again, take the earth and the soil and all the processes that go on, as we say, naturally. Naturally. This is the important thing. That means it in tune with life. And whatsoever is in tune with life is a healing thing, a healing process. It makes whole. It releases the holiness of that which is. And if we can appreciate that and see it, we too are interacting with the earth as such, and we too experience that holiness which makes life sweet. I think when this sort of sweetness of life is present, then one need never bother about making clear intellectual formulations as regards how the developmental process should go or ought to go or can go. It will all happen by itself. And we shall learn one very important thing. We as we are, as psychophysical persons, desiring this, longing for that, aiming for this, trying to grasp this, that and the other. We are obstructors of the natural process. You know how sometimes we wonder when we meet somebody who is quite exceptional and we say, I wonder how that man or that woman happens to be so lovely and beautiful and in character, in action and so forth. And then we say sometimes, somebody may say, but he or she was born like that. That is only another way of saying that naturally he or she is in tune with life and the entire life process. Now you're a clever biologist, or not biologist. You're a man who knows all about how life goes on in nature, red in tooth and claw. He will say this is all wishful thinking or something like that. This is not wishful thinking. He sees the red in tooth and claw process, but the red in tooth and claw process is part of the natural sweetness of life. It's a terrible thing to say, isn't it? You see, the universe lives upon itself. You and I, as separate organisms, need to feed ourselves. So we live upon something. The beasts of prey, as we call them, they live upon other animals and so forth. And throughout nature we see this something which lives upon and sustains itself by interacting with something else. Now, we having our values approve of this, that or the other, and we disapprove of this, that or the other. We talk about the cruel beast as he pounces on his prey and so forth. But what are the things I pounce upon for my living? Do I do any pouncing? Of course I do. If I, as a parent, desire my child to grow like this, to behave like that, etc., etc., I'm pouncing upon him. I don't let him grow. That doesn't mean that if he wants to take a knife and plunge it into mama or myself, you see, I should let him do it. It doesn't mean that. But then, you see, the art of prevention is a very subtle art, and it is practically one may almost say it is a holy art, how to effect right prevention. You see, right prevention can take place through true love and understanding, and that means no possessiveness, no imposition upon the other, no demanding from the other, no expectations, no hopes, and all the rest of it. Let be, the thing will happen, it will go on. When the universe came into being, we were not there. There was no one to hope or expect anything out of the universe. It all happened. So you see, if there is the strength and the creative power which is involved with the peace and purity of the psyche, then the right happening can take place, the right preventing can take place. Otherwise not. Otherwise, look at this Argentina, Britain, ding-dong relationship which goes on. You see, folly all along the line, everywhere. And lack of love. The possessiveness, the passion to hold, power and all the rest of it, all that is involved, you see. And things are bound to go wrong. We pride ourselves on being civilized nations. We are civilized only in the very literal sense of literal meaning of the word civilized, which is derived from civis, the Latin civis, meaning estate. A state, and the states of those days, the civitas, the civis and the civitas, the society, was confined to a particular town or a city. That's all. It was something confined. It didn't involve universal love or understanding and so on. It didn't involve that. So, with regard to our developmental process, don't try to define it too much. Make a rigid intellectual picture of it. Just a general feel of it. Greater refinement. Greater and greater sensitivity, above all. And of course, all that is the result of purification. It comes about, and let it come about naturally. It seems to me that I must really stop there today.